Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We usually like to ease you into a topic, maybe start with a fun fact or a gentle introduction. But today we can't really do that.
No, definitely not.
We're staring directly into the dark. We're tackling a story that is unsettling, frankly, shocking, but also undeniably fascinating. We're talking about Peter Schaffer's 1973 play Equus.
It is a really heavy one. And honestly, it's one of those pieces of theater that leaves a mark on you. You don't just watch it, you survive it.
That is a perfect way to put it, because the hook here, the thing that grabs you by the throat right away, is the crime. And it's not a spoiler because it's the premise of the whole show.
Yeah.
A 17-year-old boy, Alan Strang, takes a metal spike and blinds six horses in a stable.
It is a horrific image, just visceral.
It's the definition of a nightmare. But here's the thing, and this is why we're doing deep dive on it based on the Wikipedia entry and historical breakdowns of Schaffer's work. The play isn't a whodunit.
Right, we know exactly who did it.
Yeah, we know Alan did it. We know
Yeah.
how he did it. The material makes clear that this is a whodunit.
Oh, exactly. Or even more accurately, it's a what is it? It's an investigation into what it means to be normal versus what it means to be alive. Schaffer isn't just showing us a crime, he's constructing a theology. He's building a detective story of the mind to figure out how a quiet, polite boy creates a private religion that ends in blood.
And what I found so wild in the research is the origin story of the play itself. Schaffer didn't just conjure this up out of nowhere.
No, he didn't.
He was driving with a friend, I think, and heard about a real crime in northern England where a boy blinded 26 horses.
That's right. A really grim reality.
And here's the twist that tells you everything about Schaffer as a writer.
Yeah.
He intentionally stopped his friend from telling him the details. He didn't want to know the boy's background.
He shut it down completely.
Yeah, he didn't want the real psychiatric report. He wanted to write a fictional account of the cause to create what he called a numinous quality.
That word is critical here, numinous.
It's a great word, but it's a bit abstract. When Schaffer says numinous, what are we actually talking about?
He's talking about the sensation of the divine, but not the nice Sunday school version of the divine. He means the ancient, terrifying presence of a god.
Like Old Testament stuff.
Exactly, the kind of thing that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. Awe and terror combined. Schaffer knew that if he found out the real boy was, just say, abused or had a chemical imbalance, it becomes a clinical case study.
It becomes small.
Right, it becomes small. He wanted to write a myth, similar to his previous work, The Royal Hunt of the Sun.
So he invents the characters. He gives us Alan Strang, the boy, and
Yeah.
Dr. Martin Dysart, the psychiatrist. And on paper, this looks like a standard setup, right? The troubled kid and the doctor who is going to fix him.
Right, the rational adult saving the irrational child.
But as soon as you scratch the surface, that dynamic totally flips.
Yeah.
Dysart is the one who seems broken.
Dysart is absolutely in crisis. He works in a psychiatric hospital in southern England, and if you look at his opening monologues, he sounds less like a doctor and more like a man who has lost his faith. He feels like a glorified mechanic.
A mechanic for the human mind.
But a mechanic who hates the repair job, he sees his job as taking these unique, sharp, jagged kids and adjusting them until they fit into a normal existence.
But to Dysart, normal is just a synonym for dead.
It's dull. It's a life without worship.
He actually says that, doesn't he? That his life lacks worship.
Which brings us to the nightmare. I really want to spend a minute here because this dream Dysart has in Act One is, well, it's incredibly graphic. It's not just a standard anxiety dream.
No, it's a vision of judgment. In the dream, Dysart is in a Homeric Grecian setting. He's a high priest wearing a gold mask,
Matt.
and he is presiding over a ritual sacrifice.
Right.
He's slicing open the abdomens of children, hundreds of them, and pulling out their entrails to read the future.
That is just stomach turning. He's gutting children.
Yes. And the horror of the dream isn't just the violence, it's that beneath the mask, the real Dysart is disgusted. He's nauseous. He hates what he's doing.
And he keeps doing it. That is the kicker. He can't stop because he's terrified that the other priests standing around him will notice his hesitation. He's afraid they'll expose him as a non-believer if he puts down the knife.
Okay, that is heavy.
Yeah.
So the children are his patients.
Precisely. He feels that by curing them, by stripping away their madness, he's effectively gutting them. He's taking out their entrails, their individuality, their passion, just to make them fit into society.
And he's doing it just to keep his status as a priest of normalcy. He feels like a total fraud.
Yes. That's a devastating way to view psychiatry. Most people would say, hey, if a kid is hallucinating, helping him stop is a good thing.
But Dysart isn't so sure.
Because Dysart looks at his own life, a marriage that has gone cold. a job that is just paperwork and adjustments, and he wonders, is this it? Is this what I'm saving them for? To be bored like me.
So enter Alan Strang, the boy who isn't bored. The boy who is vibrating with intensity. Dysart has to play detective to figure out how this quiet kid ends up in a stable with a spike.
And this is where we have to be careful not to oversimplify. It's easy to look at Alan's parents and say, aha, bad parenting. But the source material shows it's much more complex than that. It's a collision of worlds.
You've got the mother, Dora, and the father, Frank.
Yeah.
And they seem like they're living in two completely different realities.
They absolutely are. Dora is a devout Christian. She reads the Bible to Alan. She talks about the suffering of Christ. She gives Alan this very intense, bloody imagery of religion.
And of Frank.
Frank is an atheist. He views religion as a dangerous drug and is aggressive about it. So Alan is trapped in this crossfire, intense religious romanticism from mom and intense cynicism from dad.
We should emphasize that the play isn't taking a side here. It's not saying the religious mother is right or the atheist father is right. It's just showing how these two extreme polarities crash into each other inside this kid's head.
Exactly. It's the friction between them that creates the spark.
And the spark that lights the fuse is the picture in the bedroom. This detail really stood out to me in the research.
It is the catalyst. Alan had a graphic picture of Jesus on the cross at the foot of his bed. Frank, the father, tore it down. He thought it was too morbid.
Which, to be fair, waking up to a torture scene every morning might not be great for a kid.
Sure. But look at what Alan does. He doesn't just leave the wall blank. He replaces the picture of Jesus with a picture of a horse. A horse with huge, staring eyes.
And this is where the theology begins, right?
Yeah.
Alan doesn't just like ponies. He starts fusing things.
It's a brilliant, desperate act of synthesis. He takes the religious agony and worship he learned from his mother. He mixes it with the Westerns and cowboy movies he sneaks off to watch. Also, his grandfather's interest in horses plays a part.
He projects all of that onto the horse.
Yes. The horse becomes his Jesus.
It's like he's building his own private cult.
He is. And there's a specific memory that cements this. When Alan was 6 on a beach, a rider picked him up and let him sit on a horse.
And we need to talk about the sensory details here because they matter.
They matter immensely. Alan feels the horse's sweat, the muscle moving between his legs, the power, the smell. It's an overwhelming sensory experience for a 6-year-old.
And then his father pulls him off violently.
Exactly. So in one moment, you have pleasure, power, physical connection, and then punishment. That moment fused religious adoration and sexual attraction in his mind. The horse became a source of love, fear, and taboo desire.
It became a god that you can touch, which leads us to the rituals. Because Alan eventually gets a job at a stable owned by a guy named Harry Dalton. And this is where things get intense.
By day, Alan is a good worker. He grooms, he cleans. But Dysart uses hypnosis to find out what happens at night. This is the secret life of Alan Strang.
He picks one horse, Nugget.
Nugget becomes the avatar for his god, Equus. And the ritual Alan performs is, well, it's ecstatic. He strips completely naked. He rides the horse bareback in the middle of the night.
And it's not just riding. It's worship.
It is sexual and spiritual. He works himself into a frenzy. He envisions himself as a king and the horse as his god. He shouts, mine. You're mine. It's possession and submission all at once.
There's also that detail about the bit, the metal piece in the horse's mouth. Alan hates it.
He calls it the chains of sins. He wants to take the bit out. He sees it as mankind enslaving the divine. He wants to free his god.
You know, when you describe it like that, it's terrifying, but it's also kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
In a twisted way, he feels something so much stronger than anything I feel on a Tuesday afternoon.
And that is exactly what Dysart feels. He listens to these tapes of Alan under hypnosis, describing this midnight gallop, the sweat, the moonlight, the unity with the animal, and Dysart is jealous.
He's jealous of a patient he's supposed to be curing.
Dysart has a wife he hasn't kissed in years. He has a pristine house, he buys books on Greek art, but he has never felt one minute of the passion Alan feels every night in that stable.
But passion has a price. We have to talk about the blinding. How do we go from I worship this horse to I'm going to destroy it?
It starts with the intrusion of the real world. A girl named Jill Mason. She works at the stables. She's outgoing, free-spirited, and she likes Alan.
She asks him out.
She does. She takes him to an adult movie theater. And in a cruel twist of fate, they run into Alan's father, Frank.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns.
Exactly. Frank tries to lie about why he's there, claiming he's waiting for a client, but Alan sees through it. He realizes his dad has a secret, dirty little life, too. The source material suggests this actually makes sex seem human and accessible to Alan for the first time.
It knocks the father off the pedestal.
It does. So he thinks maybe he can be normal. He goes with Jill back to the stable.
They sneak in. Jill seduces him. They start to undress. They try to have sex in the straw.
Yeah.
But the horses are there.
They're in the temple. Alan can hear them breathing. He can hear hooves shifting. And suddenly he can't perform. He's impotent. In his mind, the eyes of the horses, the eyes of Equus, are boring into him.
He thinks they're judging him.
He thinks he's an apostate. He's betraying his god for a human girl. He hallucinates the voice of Equus saying, "The Lord thy God is a jealous god." He screams, "God seest."
God seest. That line gives me chills.
It's the ultimate shame. He feels exposed. And in a total panic to stop the eyes from seeing his sin, he grabs the metal hoof pick. And he strikes.
He blinds them.
He blinds all six horses, not because he hates them, but because he can't bear to be seen by them. He has to kill the witness.
It's a religious panic. It's not random violence. It's a desperate attempt to hide his soul.
And this brings us to the visual aspect of the play, which is crucial to understanding this violence. We need to talk about the masks.
Right. In the stage production, and this is famous, they don't use real horses.
No, Schaffer was very specific about this. The horses are played by actors wearing wire masks and elevated hooves. They are stylized, they are abstract.
Why does that matter? Why not use a real horse if you wanted to be realistic?
Because if you put a real horse on stage, the audience just sees an animal. They see a pony. But when you put a human in a wire mask, the audience has to use their imagination. They project the spirit of the horse onto the actor, just like Alan projects his god onto the horse.
So the wire mask allows us to see what Alan sees.
Exactly. It makes the numinous visible. And this is actually where the 1977 film adaptation, directed by Sidney Lumet, failed for a lot of critics. They used real horses.
I can imagine that changes the vibe completely.
It does. Scholar James M. Welsh and others pointed out that when you film a real horse getting blinded, even with special effects, it's just gore. It's repulsive. It becomes a horror movie about animal cruelty.
But on stage with the masks, it remains a tragedy about the human mind. It keeps the focus on the ritual, not the blood.
That abstraction keeps it in the realm of the psychological.
Which brings us back to Dysart's dilemma. Now that he knows the truth, that this wasn't just violence, but a failed ritual, he knows he can cure Alan.
He can take the pain away.
He can. He can use therapy and medication to dismantle Alan's theology. He can make him normal. But this is where the play hits us with its central philosophical conflict, the Apollonian versus the Dionysian.
We see these terms thrown around in lit class, but let's break them down for the real world. It comes from Nietzsche, mostly. The Apollonian, named after Apollo, is the side of us that values reason, order, light society structure.
That is Dysart's world. That is the hospital.
And the Dionysian is Dionysus, the god of wine, chaos, madness, instinct, passion. That is Alan's world. It's messy, it's dangerous, but it is alive.
And the conflict is that you can't really have both.
That's the tragedy. Society demands we be Apollonian. We have to pay taxes, drive the speed limit, and not blind horses. But Dysart worries that by enforcing that order, we are killing the Dionysian spark that makes life worth living.
So wait, is the play saying we should be like Alan? Should we be running around naked and worshiping animals?
No, and that's the uncomfortable tension. We can't have Alan's running around. He's dangerous. He caused immense suffering. He needs to be stopped. But Dysart's point is, what is the cost of stopping him?
There's that final monologue. It's one of the most famous in theater. Heavy hitters have played Dysart, right? Anthony Hopkins won a Tony for it. Richard Burton, Leonard Nimoy, Anthony Perkins.
Incredible actors. And in that monologue, Dysart talks about what Alan will be like after the cure. He says Alan will be a ghost.
A ghost.
He says, "I'll give him the normal world and he won't know a thing about it. He'll essentially be a shell. He'll be safe. He'll be a productive citizen. He might even get married and buy a car. But you'll never again feel the intensity of that ride on Equus."
Passion, you see, can be destroyed by a doctor. It cannot be created.
Exactly. Dysart feels that he is standing in the dark with a pick in his hand, striking at heads.
Yeah.
He realizes that by making people normal, he's destroying the very thing that makes them unique.
He's the high priest of the boring safe life, and he hates himself for it.
It's interesting you mention the unique nature of this role. It requires an actor to be incredibly vulnerable. I know we mentioned the film, but the 2007 London and Broadway revival was a massive moment for this play.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
That was the Daniel Radcliffe production alongside Richard Griffiths. And everyone made a big deal about it because, Harry Potter was getting naked on stage.
The media frenzy was intense. Radcliffe was 17. But I think that casting was actually brilliant for the themes we're talking about.
How so?
He was trying to break out of this perfectly curated, safe image of the boy wizard, the ultimate Apollonian hero in a way, and he threw himself into this raw, exposed Dionysian role.
He defended the nudity, didn't he?
He did. He said it wasn't gratuitous. And he's right. For the scene to work, for the audience to understand Alan's total submission to the horse, he has to be stripped bare, physically and emotionally. If he's wearing underwear, he's still holding something back from his god.
It's a brave move. It forces the audience to look at the human body and the human psyche without any filters.
And that's what Equus does. It rips the mask off civilized life.
So let's bring this home. We've gone from a horrific crime to a family drama to a religious ritual and finally to a philosophical crisis.
It's a lot.
It is. But I think it leaves us with a question that touches everyone, not just people interested in psychiatry. We all make a trade-off.
We do, every day. We trade the danger of extreme passion for the safety of a normal life. We choose comfort over intensity.
And usually that's the right choice. I like my comfort. I like not being in jail.
Of course. But Dysart's burden and the burden Schaffer puts on us is to acknowledge what we lose in that trade.
We lose the worship.
We do.
That brings us to the final thought for the listener. And I think this is the one that's going to keep me up tonight.
I think the provocation is this. In a world that prioritizes normalcy above everything else, a world that wants to medicate away every extreme feeling and smooth out every rough edge, is it possible that by curing our madness, we are actually killing the only part of us that is truly alive?
Are we just creating a world of ghosts?
We might be. And we have to ask if that safety is worth the silence.
But taking it even a step further beyond just the trade-off, it makes you wonder if the very structures we build to keep us so safe and normal are actually what drive us to these violent extremes in the first place. Like if Dysart's sterile, passionless world is exactly what forces a kid like Alan to invent a bloody god just to feel something.
The Apollonian cage creating the Dionysian monster.
Exactly. That is terrifying.
Dead.
And profound. Thank you for walking us through the dark today.
Always a pleasure, even in the dark.
And to you listening, thanks for taking the dive. We'll see you next time.